William Tong, thanks for being here.
Ron, great to see you, and thanks for having us here.
Have you come down from that adrenaline high of being elected?
I don't know if it was such an adrenaline high. I think people, when they ask me about how I'm feeling, you know, they say you must be over the moon about it. And the answer is I'm still exhausted from a year-long campaign. I've got Eleanor, Penelope, and Sasha, 12, 10, and 7.
That's work. That's real work.
They're all at home right now. Each of them has a fever. They're, you know, we've got this virus ripping through our area among school kids. So I'm just glad to be back home with my kids and my wife and being dad again and taking the opportunity before we take office to really focus on them.
I've been there. I've done that. I empathize and sympathize.
Yes.
In the press, you're almost always referred to as William Tong, first Asian American or Asian Pacific American. You ever get tired of that? Do you just want finally there to be a day when it's just William Tong?
I don't think I get tired of it. I don't think it's something that I want people to lead with forever, because I think it's really just important to focus on our work and to focus on the job of protecting and defending Connecticut's families. There's so much on our plate right now. I was just at the meeting of the National Association of Attorneys General, and so I was sitting in a horseshoe with all 50 states, and that was a real eye-opening experience, you know, with multiple fire hoses, you know, coming at me at the same time. But at the same time, I think the fact that this was a historic candidacy and a historic campaign, and that I have the opportunity to be the first Asian American constitutional officer, still has meaning, and it's important, because in this moment, I think a lot of people feel like our way of life is under attack. I think there are a lot of folks, working people in particular, who feel like they're invisible, that the issues that they care about and how hard it is for them to provide for their families is overlooked or not well understood by people who are either in power or are doing much better than they are. And there's a real disconnect there. And so being the first Asian Pacific American constitutional officer, I think I'm the first Chinese American elected attorney general in our nation's history. I think it means that for those of us who spend much of our lives being invisible and who haven't before had a seat at the table or a full opportunity to participate in the democratic process, I think it means that this process is open to us, and that if you still work hard and you persist and persevere, that things like this can happen. And I take this responsibility and opportunity, you know, very, very seriously, and understand that I have a extraordinary responsibility to honor the confidence of people, particularly those who feel invisible and have been overlooked and whose concerns have not been well addressed.
You noticed our billboard in the corner, and on Thursday, we're doing a show about racism on Long Island in Connecticut.
Yep.
Is it a big problem? How would you describe it for Asian Pacific Americans, Asian Americans in Connecticut?
Is it a big problem? It's a problem for a lot of people. Racism, prejudice, discrimination, persists for all of us, and I think we're shocked sometimes because it wasn't that long ago that, and I remind people that for 8 years, I was extraordinarily proud that my three kids would only grow up in a world in which America had elected a black president. And if you think about that, Ron, the day before that happened, so many of us thought it wouldn't happen.
I didn't think it would happen in my lifetime.
Right. And even hours before it did happen, mm-hmm. most of us thought, okay, this was a great experience. We feel really good about ourselves, but it's still not going to happen. And then it happened. And then it felt like the world had changed, and it had changed. But I think people thought that that experience of having Barack Obama as our president somehow magically washed away all of the difficult experiences and heartache and prejudice and racism that this country has confronted even well before its founding. And of course, now we know that that's not true. And for all of us, particularly those of us from immigrant communities and people of color, it is something that we confront every day. And it comes at each of us differently. I think what I am happiest about, if I can say that in this conversation, or proudest of, is that I think communities of color, and that just doesn't mean racial and ethnic minorities, but also religious communities, and our friends in the LGBTQ plus community, and also people who don't come from those communities, have come together and are trying to work through these issues. And we have this conversation in a much more robust way than we did a generation ago. But racism, you know, as soon as I won the nomination, a Republican activist referred to me as Kim Jong Tong. And people were outraged. And they expected me to be outraged. And what I said to them is, this is light touch child's play racism. I've experienced so much worse. And having a conversation about that is far more important to me than some idiot referring to me in a racist way.
Almost like bring it on, big boy, huh?
Yeah, but if you want to talk about these issues, let's talk about the real issues. Let's talk about how racism and discrimination manifests itself in employment opportunities, in education, in housing.
You know that there were politicians in this past election who had to straddle the political fence because of their constituencies. That doesn't appear to be an issue with you. And I need to read right now from a Mother Jones interview that you did. You said, "I think I have a unique voice to stand up to the President of the United States and tell him, if you think you're going to ride a wave of hate and bigotry and remake our world, you're going to have to come through me and all of us. I'm just not afraid of him."
Yeah.
You're taking on the president.
Yeah. I think we all are, you know, to the extent that the president has put a target on our backs and is launching the most far-reaching and destructive attack on our way of life than I've seen in my lifetime. I think we're all standing up to him. I'll give an example. You know, we live downwind of many big polluter states. So West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania. As the president tries to make coal great again, they're eliminating or at the very least greatly reducing and loosening emission standards for air pollution. And so what happens is they make coal great again by spewing air pollution into the air, and it literally blows downwind in Connecticut. And George Jepson, our current attorney general, led a coalition of states that are downwind of those other states and sued to force the EPA to enforce what are known as good neighbor laws, which you know, are what they sound like, you know, making sure that our sister neighbor states act like good neighbors and don't pollute our air so that our kids can breathe and don't suffer from asthma and other debilitating effects of air pollution. And so that has nothing to do with really Donald Trump, you know, and his right-wing demagoguery. It has nothing to do with, you know, hot topic issues like race or sexual assault and sexual harassment, the things that we talk about every day sort of in mass media and on talk shows. But it is, you know, it represents a huge attack on our way of life and our personal health and safety. And so we have to stand to the president on not just the hot button issues that drive everybody crazy and his attack on our on people, right, and who they are, but also his attack on our environment, right? His attack on you know, our trade relationships and our economy, all those things, it's so far-reaching and destructive that we're spending a lot of time focused on that. Let me just also say, Ron, that I think people tried to divert attention away from this conversation about the damage that the president is doing to Connecticut and to our country by saying that we should talk about local issues, not national issues. But the point they're missing is that these are local issues. Air pollution, clean water, those are local issues. Those are Connecticut issues. And to the extent that Connecticut is impacted by decisions made in Washington, you know, we definitely need to focus on them with a local lens.
The executive director of the ACLU is coming on the program right after you. We're going to be talking in part about electronic tolling, and I know that's one of the things that you're interested in because it has to do with invasion of privacy, and you've talked about data privacy rights, and that's a hot-button topic with you. It appears that electronic tolling is going to take place in Connecticut probably in the next few years.
Yes.
The issue is when the tolling goes in and they're taking photographs, they're taking pictures of your license plate and pictures of you in the car, and they're able to figure out, when I say they, whomever, is able to figure out where you're driving, when you're driving, and so on. Does that concern you?
Sure. I mean, let's take a step back, first of all, and acknowledge that Connecticut has a very difficult relationship in history with tolling because of the tragedies that we've suffered here in Connecticut. And I get it. I mean, as somebody who lives in a border town or city of Stamford, it does feel like we're targeted in this whole discussion, and it's not fair. And I think tolling drives us all crazy. The challenge is that we give away our asphalt for free to tens of thousands of people every day traversing 95 and 84, and every other state virtually in the region pays for its transportation infrastructure with tolls, and we don't. And people from New York and Massachusetts and all of our neighbors, you know, they take full advantage of our roads. They have to get here and there, and we don't charge them at all for that. And you know, we have to have an honest conversation about how we pay for our roads and transportation infrastructure when we have for so long forsaken a prime source of revenue that every other state accesses through tolling. So tolling is very different than it was a generation ago, obviously. And now it's electronic and we see these gantries. And so there are a lot of legal issues around it. One legal issue is what type of tolling and how much tolling is allowed by the federal government, because these are still interstate highways. And then, you know, the legality of Ned Lamont's plan, which I support, to focus tolling efforts only on commercial vehicles and to provide for dynamic congestion pricing, so that if you're driving through Stamford, Greenwich, Fairfield, Bridgeport, during rush hour, let's just say 4:30 to 7:30 on a weekday, if you're a big truck, you may pay more during those hours than you might at 2 in the morning.
But does it bother you that when they take the photographs of your license plate or they're able to track you, they have a database then of where you're going? And it seems that nowadays, in exchange for efficiency, we're giving up so much of our privacy.
It happens every day in every transaction of modern life, really. Every time I get in my car now, I can't help myself but use Waze or some other GPS, you know.
Google Maps.
Google Maps. Because why wouldn't I want to know where the traffic is? And so I've voluntarily given up that liberty interest of letting Waze know where I am, right? And of course, that's how Waze works, is by knowing where everybody is at any time. So it can map through its program and algorithms how the traffic is flowing. And this manifests itself, obviously, in huge risk to all of us through data breaches, right? Equifax, I was an Equifax data breach customer, Home Depot. Facebook, and there's been a ton of work done by state attorneys general, particularly focused on California right now, because Javier Becerra and he's the attorney general of California, and he and many other activists and privacy activists are focused on creating legislation in California that provides much stronger protections and guidelines with respect to people's personal data. The challenge is every day, billions and billions of dollars, probably more than that even, in commercial transactions take place involving our personal data. Our personal information, our names and addresses and social security numbers are bought and sold so many times, in the course of days, weeks, and months, as just part of the many transactions that people engage in to get an edge in the commercial marketplace. And there's no doubt it's very scary. And that's one of the things that George Jepson has led the way on. He created a privacy department in the Attorney General's office that didn't exist before. And I think that will likely be a huge focus of what we do going forward.
You mentioned George Jepson, who will be leaving office soon as you take office. He has said his office is currently investigating opioid manufacturing and distributing, price fixing in the generic drug market, data privacy issue. Will your office continue these investigations?
Yes, and actually that's what I was doing this past week. As soon as I got elected, I was told I had to go to Charleston, South Carolina for the National Association of Attorneys General. And what I found there was that this is an extremely well-run professional association, but more than sort of the opportunities for networking, getting to know each other and sharing ideas, which is generally, what professional and trade associations do. This was extremely substantive, and much of what we did down in Charleston was Connecticut was giving information and updates on both of those initiatives, the generic drug manufacturer's price-fixing case, which Connecticut is the lead plaintiff in, and it's a 48-state coalition. Connecticut leads the way on that. So everyone was looking to George Jepson to tell them what the deal is and where it's going and what the next steps are. And so that was a tremendously important conversation to have. And then also Connecticut is on the executive committee of the opioids investigation. And, for several hours of our time down there, there's a lot of substantive work being done on those two issues.
What are the other main topics that you'll be tackling as soon as you take office?
As soon as I take office, I told people in this state, particularly those who are acutely aware of the attack that the Trump administration has waged on people and families, particularly those of us who are in immigrant or minority communities of color, the LGBTQ+ community, that I made it very clear that I wanted to create a civil rights division here in Connecticut. We don't have that yet. They have a civil rights division in Massachusetts and New York and in many other states where the attorney general has affirmative authority, not defensive authority, but like offensive authority to take action on behalf of Connecticut residents whose civil rights have been infringed.
So you won't be waiting for people to file a lawsuit coming to you. You will actually say, this is a problem, let's
Correct.
Be proactive.
Correct. There's a system-wide problem, for example, in housing discrimination. And we've observed this through evidence of how people are treated, for example, in housing discrimination or gender-based discrimination in a particular marketplace with respect to employment. So those are the sorts of cases that a civil rights division would take on.
When will the civil rights division be formed? Will it be quickly?
We need legislative authority to make that happen, and that's because of the particular way in which the Attorney General was the office of the Attorney General was established in this state, and because of how legally the powers of the Attorney General have come to be created and evolved over time. People don't know this, but I believe Jill Lieberman was our very first full-time Attorney General. And so, you know, every state has its own experience, but it was the Attorney General was the last constitutional officer created in 1850. And so the scope of the Attorney General's authority and jurisdiction is younger than our counterparts among the other constitutional officers, and it has evolved in a different way.
It sounds from what you're saying that you are going to have a more aggressive style, like Joe Lieberman did before he became U.S. Senator, or then Attorney General Richard Blumenthal, who is now our U.S. Senator.
Yeah, I think I'm going to continue to do what I've done in the legislature. I've been very aggressive on issues like, and you're going to talk to Dave McGuire in a few minutes, but issues like criminal justice reform, which he and I worked together on, creating a second chance society here in Connecticut, reforming our bail system, our state's gun laws, you know, creating what I think are the strongest gun laws in the nation. I'm the proudest work I've done, frankly, has been in that area and working with the Jackson family to honor the life of Lori Jackson, who was murdered by her estranged husband, and writing and passing the domestic violence gun law. So I've always been aggressive on issues like that as a legislator. And so I'll continue to be aggressive as Attorney General. And it's important to note that on some of those issues, I won't have a vote anymore in the legislature. And I may not have a pending case or litigation that gives me an opportunity to directly weigh in on an issue like criminal justice reform. I think that what previous attorneys general have shown us here in this state and across the country is that the Attorney General's office has a tremendous platform and bully pulpit, so to speak, to speak on these issues. And we have a tradition of attorneys general in Connecticut doing that, and I'll continue to be active in that way.
The sad anniversary of Sandy Hook is next Friday,
yeah,
December 14th. And as you mentioned, you have been very active in gun reform in Connecticut. The legislature is now going to tackle three gun reform proposals. Do you think that they'll have a chance in this upcoming session, considering everything else that the legislators are tackling nowadays, especially when it comes to the state budget?
I do, and I do because gun laws and gun violence are not abstractions to us here in Connecticut. It's not, I mean, you know, we passed a ban on bump stocks, and people said, well, you know, bump stocks were used in the shooting in Las Vegas. That's in Nevada on the West Coast. It's got nothing to do with Connecticut. The response to that, of course, is that it has everything to do with Connecticut, because Connecticut, maybe more than any other state, has the worst possible relationship and history and experience with gun violence. Of course, that starts with Newtown and the loss of 26 souls in Newtown. But it extends to the Jackson family, who I just mentioned. It extends to Ethan Song and his family, who we lost just this year because of what appears to be ineffective poor storage of a firearm. And so that's one of the things that they're going to address in the legislature. My colleagues in the legislature are going to be focusing on safe storage and a number of other issues. I think we have an obligation here in Connecticut to lead on this issue because we have that horrible relationship and experience with gun violence. And so I think it creates a moral obligation to lead and to honor the lives of the dead by doing as much as we can to protect other children and other families still living here in Connecticut.
You have been meeting with your fellow AGs from around the country. Have you been talking with your Democrat counterparts about linking arms to take on the Trump administration?
Yes, not just linking arms with Democrats, but also Republicans. And in all of the ways that these issues impact their states and their constituents. And so if there are Republican AGs who are impacted, for example, by what the Trump administration is doing in the EPA with respect to clean air and clean water, we're linking arms on that. But obviously there's a very close relationship between the Democratic attorneys general. I must say I'm a little starry-eyed still, and I'm sure I will be that way for some time, and get to be a bit of a fanboy when I'm around Maura Healey from Massachusetts, for example, who's not just a Democratic attorney general leader, but a national leader on so many of these issues. Javier Becerra of California. These are all Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania. These are all people that I've gotten to know some in the past year, and we're going to be meeting soon together in Washington, D.C. And it's something. It's something to sit at the table with all of them and look across the table and say, holy smokes. You know, these are heavy-duty major leaders in our country, and I've got to keep up with them.
A little intimidating, huh?
Yeah, you know, I'm not afraid to say that it is, and it's not just the multiple fire hoses that you're drinking from, but it's the size of the fire hoses that you're drinking from, and when you're having a conversation. I had a conversation with Brian Frosch, the Attorney General of Maryland, just a few days ago, and we were talking about his work in blocking and questioning the authority of the president to nominate and impanel Matthew Whitaker as the Attorney General. You know, just having that conversation with him over a cup of soup is a new experience, to say the least. But you know, I think I felt that way the first time I had to confront our state's gun laws, or in the middle of the financial crisis, I was the chair of the banking committee and had to sit across the table from the big banks and in a way sort of stare down some pretty heavy duty forces who I thought needed to do better for Connecticut homeowners. And so, you know, you get these opportunities and you rise to the occasion.
I only have 30 seconds left with you. One last question. I know you went to the University of Chicago Law School and you had some professor by the name of...
Yeah.
I can't think of his name right now. Obama. Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Right.
Nice guy.
What was it like having him as your professor?
You know, he's what he presents as publicly. He's extraordinarily smart. He's a little cool. So he's not a super, you know, gregarious backslapper politician. But he's very thoughtful. He's very knowledgeable. I learned much of what I know about civil rights, the 14th Amendment, equal protection from Barack Obama. We had a sense at that time that something was going to happen with him, but I don't think any of us students knew that he was going to be president of the United States a few short years after we graduated. But it was an amazing experience to learn from him.
William Tong, soon he will be Connecticut's new Attorney General. Thank you, sir. I appreciate you coming in. And let me be the first to say happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays to you.
Thank you. And I hope the kids are feeling better.
Yeah. Don't eat too much.
You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. We'll be right back.